Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners. Open year-round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a show about gardening, agriculture, and wild habitat. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. In this episode, we talk to Catherine Shakey, the invasive species manager at Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, about invasive weeds as well as weeds that we can find in our garden. And then we go to the brew shop and join Sean Cullerton and Steve McCaslin to make some dandelion mead. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Catherine Shakey. I'm the Invasive Species Program Manager at Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. One part of my job is to coordinate the Kenai Peninsula Cooperative Invasive Species Management Area, which is a partnership of federal and state agencies and nonprofits and tribal entities across the region. And we collaborate on sharing resources, funding, strategic management plans for specific plants, and we are tackling the highest priority invasive plants throughout the Kenai and do permitting for treating infestations of orange hawkweed, bird vetch, white sweet clover, and reed canary grass in remote areas along roadways, high-risk pathways like trail systems. So that really is focused on a landscape perspective on protecting wilderness, not wilderness with a capital W, but wild intact ecosystems across the Kenai. So a lot of our federal lands, the Kenai Fjords National Park, Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, and the Chugach National Forest, a lot of that land is not easily accessible by people, which means we want to really try to protect those areas from invasive plants.
Can you talk a little bit about what invasive species are?
Sure. Not all non-native plants are created equal, and not all non-native plants are considered invasive. In order to be an invasive plant, you have to meet two criteria. You have to be introduced to the ecosystem, so not native, and you have to cause harm either to the environment, to the economy, people's livelihoods, or direct harm to humans. And I should also mention that there's a really great tool that the Alaska Natural Heritage Program created years ago. They're now the UAA, Alaska Center for Conservation Science, and they have an invasive plant ranking system based on a scale of 0 to 100. And so basically a non-native plant gets put through this matrix where its biology is evaluated, how it reproduces, and how quickly it can reproduce. Can it outcompete native plants? How much does it alter an ecosystem? And then how hard is it to get rid of? So based on all those things, if something's ranked basically above 60 on that scale, it's considered a pretty aggressive invasive plant, and it has the potential to outcompete an intact native ecosystem.
What are some of the more detrimental plants in Alaska, or plants that rank above that 60 mark?
The poster child is the orange hawkweed. That one's ranked in the 80s. It is notoriously difficult to get rid of. If you've ever had it in your lawn, you know this. And one of the reasons it's ranked so high is because it can reproduce in three ways. So not just by seed, but by underground rhizomes or roots and above ground stolons like strawberries. And if you aggravate the plant, try to, you know, pick it or mow it, it's going to stimulate it to spread out laterally and increase its vegetative growth. And it can creep into intact boreal ecosystems. So you'll find it growing under alders and along streams. And so we're really trying to keep that one out of our wild natural places. Reed canary grass would be another one too.
Can you describe the orange hawkweed so that people can identify it?
Yeah. So it is pretty easy to identify because it's our only dark orange. Some people think it even looks reddish in color flower. It's an aster, so it has lots of small petals that come out from the center of the flower. It gets to be about 12 feet tall, and it's very hairy. So there are these fine... 12 inches. Thank goodness we don't have 12-foot tall orange hawkweed around. That would be a whole nother nightmare. Yeah, 12 inches tall. And it has small black hairs up and down the stems and on the basal rosettes, so the leaves at the base of the ground, and all the way up into the bud of the flower. And when it does go to seed, it turns into, it looks like a little mini dandelion, which is also in the same aster family, in that it's got windblown seeds that can travel quite a distance. So if you see an orange or red hairy flower about a foot tall, look around, you'll probably find a lot more of it. So Diamond Ridge in Homer is very infested with it. There are a lot of roadsides around town that have it. Some people's lawns, if they've got it in there and they've been mowing their lawn, they might have a monoculture of just orange hawkweed in their lawn.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw some orange hawkweed near the radio station behind a local Pioneer bar.
Yeah, there you go. Yep, it's around. And Homer's the source of orange hawkweed for the rest of the Kenai Peninsula for the most part. So as we get further away from Homer across the Kenai, we start to put some more partnership resources into trying to eradicate it because we do want to protect, you know, our pristine wild landscapes from the orange hawkweed. But in urban areas, it's kind of hard. You need all landowners working together to get rid of it.
Do we know where the orange hawkweed originally came from?
It is a European species, so it's from Europe. And there are a lot of other hawk, like yellow hawkweed species too, that are also European. And then we also have some native hawkweed species that are here, but none of them are orange. So I've heard some rumors in the past that maybe it was actually brought over from Russia originally, but I actually don't know for sure. Probably someone thought it was pretty and brought it over as an ornamental. And that's how a lot of invasive plants get here, is they're thought of as really beautiful ornamentals, and we don't realize that they're going to jump the fence and invade our salmon streams.
So what are some other invasive plants?
So along the ornamental theme, the European bird cherry or mayday tree is a really beautiful, popular flowering ornamental that produces these cherries that the birds really love. They transport those cherries up to 4 miles away from the mother trees. And those have invaded salmon streams all over the state of Alaska and urban areas. So we're definitely concerned about the mayday or chokecherry trees. And then also reed canary grass, which was originally brought in to help stabilize erosion along roadways and also as a forage crop for cattle. At the time, it was thought the seeds weren't viable, but that turned out to be false. And reed canary grass is very efficient at filling in wetlands, filling in stream sides, and it can create just a solid mat of sod, which is not something that our Calamagrostis, the native grass that looks similar, doesn't necessarily behave that way. And so this reed canary grass alters the hydrology that our salmon depend upon, and that's why we're so concerned about it.
So it sucks up the water?
It sucks up the water, and it, so if it's growing along a stream, it will trap sediment, a lot of that glacial silt as it's flowing down, and then as it builds up trapped sediment, it slows the water flow, and that can actually warm the stream, create a shallower stream. You lose these little bubbly pockets that the baby salmon need to actually get oxygen and feed on insects. And it can also, I don't think there are any studies on this at the moment, but in other parts of the country, it's been shown to change insect populations. And of course, those insects growing along streams fall into the stream and feed our baby salmon. So that's another concern. Yeah, reed canary grass can grow completely submerged in the stream and in semi-wet environments and in completely dry slopes. So, you know, this plant is ranked in the upper 80s on the invasiveness scale because it is so aggressive and can grow in so many environments.
Who introduced it?
I don't know exactly who. I think it may be that it was brought up by a state agency for erosion control along roadways. And then I also think that some folks who had livestock may have brought it up for forage, because there are some varieties that are very nutritious for cattle. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A lot of these, like bird vetch is another really invasive plant that was originally brought up for cover crop programs, I think through a federal program. So sometimes it's agency folks who bring up these plants without realizing it, and sometimes it's landowners who think the plant is pretty, or landowners trying to find a forage crop.
With the reed canary grass, probably most people, unless, you know, they grow hay, don't really know how to distinguish different grasses.
Yeah.
How can they tell if something is reed canary grass?
Reed canary grass is really tough to identify this time of year in the spring and midsummer. It's easily identified in the fall, especially as you get into September and sometimes even into October, because it stays green much later than any of the other native grasses, and it will really pop out. It has, in general, very broad leaves. The beech rye that grows down in the sand on the beach, that has a broad leaf also, but it only has leaves at the base of its stem, whereas the reed canary grass has leaves up and down the stem. And they tend to be pretty pokey looking, like come out of the stem at a 45 degree angle. And then it has about a 4 to 6 inch seed head on the top that's very tightly closed and straw colored. So yeah, September, October, if there's a bright green grass and everything else has senesced or turned brown around it, chances are good that's reed canary grass. And we have a lot of it around Homer. A lot of the streams on the Kenai Peninsula have it, so much so that we have had to prioritize which watersheds we're going to focus resources on trying to protect from reed canary grass.
What is the next step after someone identifies that they have an invasive plant on their property?
The next step is to learn more about that plant, because the type of control or management option that you might use depends on the biological characteristics of the plant. For instance, if you have a field full of reed canary grass, you're looking at only suppressing a population, probably not able to eradicate it. And if you mow reed canary grass, you're at least preventing it from going to seed. But it can send out 10 feet of rhizomes, so underground roots, every year. So it's going to spread that way still. So oftentimes, it really depends on the site. You know, there are some great resources available. If you go to our website, kenaiinvasives.org, you can look up specific species. And then there's biology sheets that will tell you what type of control plant responds to. Sometimes manual digging is sufficient, but with things like orange hawkweed and reed canary grass, that doesn't work. If you're really trying to eradicate, usually you have to use some form of chemical or herbicide response, but you can use that in combination with manual removal or tarping to also reduce the populations. And then also taking care of your landscape. What are you trying to do with that piece of property? If you're trying to grow something else, then, you know, understanding what your soil is like, maybe you need to add some nutrients, some fertilization to make it a more conducive environment to encourage competition from other species you do want to grow there.
Last year, Homer Soil and Water had a chokecherry program. Is that still something that's going on?
Yeah, so we do still have our chokecherry Mayday tree program going on. We're offering a $100 reimbursement for any landowner who lets us know they have these invasive prunus trees on their property. We have to go out and get a visual on them and confirm the species. If they remove all of their invasive Mayday and chokecherry trees, then send us a picture, or we go back out and do a site visit and confirm they've been removed. They can purchase an alternative ornamental tree or shrub and then send us the receipt, and we'll reimburse them for up to $100. So that's one option.
Are there any plants that aren't in Alaska yet, but are on the radar of these organizations?
Overall, I would say in Alaska, we're still really lucky with invasive species. We have a lot of species that we don't have to deal with yet, that the lower 48 or even Canadian provinces are dealing with. That goes for plants and other organisms, fish, invasive zebra mussels, European green crabs, and marine species that can decimate aquaculture. We definitely try to do a lot of outreach on prevention and how to properly clean gear and equipment, purchase certified weed-free hay and gravel if you're bringing anything from out of state. Certainly one of our biggest concerns with aquatic invasives and not just aquatic invasive plants. You know, right now, Elodia is the only non-native aquatic invasive plant that has been introduced to Alaska, but there are several others, Eurasian milfoil, also freshwater snails, freshwater zebra mussels. Those can travel in the bilge water components of boats. And as we've started doing a couple of years ago, I think it was Fish and Wildlife Service up at the refuge, the Tetlin refuge boundary and the Canadian border, we're starting to do some boat inspections. And there was a sailboat that came up from the Great Lakes, and they did find some dried zebra mussels in the hull of that boat. So that is a big warning system. You know, they if they're completely dried, then they're dead and they aren't able to reproduce. But that doesn't mean that the little earlier stages of life, they can live in water for a long time. So certainly cleaning, draining, and drying all components of your boat before you bring anything from outside Alaska is important. And then there's some other ornamental plants that we really don't want up here. Japanese knotweed is in a few places in Alaska, but
oh my gosh,
yeah, that's a horrible one.
Its roots can go through concrete.
Yeah, and they're really hard to kill. I mean, even knocking it back with herbicide doesn't usually work. You have to keep on it for several years. I know there's one plant, I think in Ketchikan, that they've been cutting back and trying to kill for, I think, over a decade. We did actually catch potentially one Japanese knotweed up in the Kenai area because someone posted on Facebook. And so we have one of our partners up there going to check it out to see if that's what it is. And also there was one Japanese knotweed plant found on a property here in Homer that was removed successfully. You know, that, and then also, you know, Himalayan blackberry, that would be one I would really encourage people to be careful about bringing up to Alaska. If you've lived in the Pacific Northwest, you've seen how it's taken over roadsides and forests. And while it may be hard for Himalayan blackberry to survive for a few years, with all the climatic shifts happening up here and temperature variability and summer seasons getting longer, it could just be a matter of time before Himalayan blackberry could take over up here too.
So I grew up on the East Coast where Japanese knotweed and also kudzu are a big deal. And we would harvest the shoots of the knotweed plant in the springtime, kind of like rhubarb, and make them into a pie. I'm wondering if there's any invasive plants that you can eat in Alaska.
First thing that comes to mind are the signal crayfish over in Kodiak, because it's not a plant, but an invasive species that was introduced. And they are encouraging harvesting of the signal crayfish to try to get them out of the Buskin watershed. They're really tasty, but we also don't want to create a market for it so that people are intentionally introducing them or trying to keep them around. So I think that's where the educational component of, you know, these organisms, if they have the ability to reproduce so fast and alter the building blocks of our ecosystem, we're putting all the other things we value as Alaskans at risk, our salmon and wildlife habitat. But there are a lot of invasive plants and non-native plants that are edible and can be eaten. Not the orange hawkweed, and I wouldn't recommend the reed canary grass, but the moderately to weakly invasive plants that aren't able to take over intact boreal forest, but you might find in your garden or along your driveway, a lot of those are edible.
Are pheasants invasive?
Pheasants are non-native. They're feral, right? Introduced to Homer. And I have been wondering that myself. What are they doing to the landscape out there? I imagine that they are getting plucked off and eaten by predators and larger raptors here and there. But there's no data as far as I know. There's no research. I think it would be a great research project for somebody to take on.
So last year we were talking with the state entomologist with the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, and he was talking about how several bugs have become invasive because of warmer summer temperatures. I'm wondering if climate change will encourage the proliferation of more invasive plants in Alaska.
Definitely, I would say. You know, I started off working in Denali National Park in 2005 and worked 8 seasons there. And originally, when people would ask about invasive plants, I would say, the winter's too harsh, the summer season's too short, we don't have that many invasive plants up here. And I wouldn't say that anymore. That's not true. So certainly, I would use the Prunus patis, the Mayday tree or European bird cherry, and the choke cherry, Prunus virginiana, is a good example of that. There's kind of two components to think about with what allows an invasive species or an invasive plant to take over a landscape. With those Mayday trees, they were planted at a really high rate all over the state. And then as the climate has shifted and we have longer growing seasons, we have warmer temperatures, the cold doesn't get as cold in the winter. That may have contributed to allowing the Prunus patus and virginiana to just take off in a lot of these stream corridors and wetland areas and moose habitat. You know, some of these wetlands and bog areas are drying up in some places, so that means that the soil may not be as acidic as it once was. That means that the native trees that are adapted to that really wet, acidic soil no longer have a competitive edge against some of these introduced species. I don't know of any direct recent research about invasive plants and climate change in Alaska, but I do know that we're seeing more dramatic impacts to, like, our pollinators. White sweet clover, a really tall, like 6 foot tall plant that has really small white flowers up and down it. So not your ground cover clover, but Melilotus alba has been widely established in Fairbanks in the last 15 years. And there are studies from UAF that show that white sweet clover has all this juicy, nutritious nectar in it. And so it's attracting native pollinators to it and away from some of the native plants. So, you know, there's all these cause and effect consequences. So we also focus on prevention. As an Alaskan, one of the best things you can do is practice some of these campaigns like Play Clean Go. We have installed some boot brush stations across the Kenai Peninsula at trailheads and at the Homer Harbor. And so anytime before you go across to Ketchumek Bay, which is somewhere we can protect from invasive plants, if you use that boot brush station, you're going to scrub off any seeds or root fragments that might be hitching a ride on your boot.
Where is it located?
It's at the top of Ramp 2, so one of the main water taxi ramps there. It's just to the right of the ramp.
I'm wondering if we can shift gears and talk more about some common weeds that you would find in a garden.
Sure. So one thing I want to say is weeds is a very subjective term. It can mean different things to different people. It's often in the eye of the beholder. So some of our native plants, like the native pushke or cow parsnip, is considered a weed by, say, a hay farmer who's trying to maintain timothy in their field. Some of the non-native typical weeds you might find in disturbed areas, driveways, gardens, agricultural lots are common dandelion and pineapple weed and plantain, chickweed. These are all things that gardeners struggle with a lot that are introduced species but are here to stay and stick around because they are, most of them are European species that are widely distributed across the globe.
Is there anything that we can tell about the soil based on what weeds grow there?
In general, in non-native plants or plants that are considered weedy by nature thrive in low nutrient environments. In recently disturbed areas, they could be considered pioneer species. So in Europe, they're probably one of the first species to move in after a landscape has been scarred. Here in Alaska, our native pioneer species are things like fireweed, yarrow, wormwood, or artemisia. So basically, if you've got some of these plantain, common dandelion, the fall dandelion growing, then they have poor nutrients in the soil. You know, there's a lot of the low clover, alsike clover and red clover, those are the trifolium species. They can often add nitrogen into the soil, which is why they're used as a cover crop at times. But in general, if you're trying to combat some of these weeds, one tactic is to fertilize your soil and add nutrients into it so that you're able to encourage the plants that you do want to grow there to have enough nutrients and not have to compete against an introduced plant that's really good at surviving in a low nutrient environment.
Is there anything that I can use the weeds for once I pull them out?
Yeah, so my strategy when I'm picking dandelions on my property in the spring is to eat them. And you can eat every part of a dandelion. This is Taraxacum officinale. And I actually want to preface all of this by saying that herbs are pretty potent, and so it's best to consult with your doctor before you start introducing a new plant into your diet, or do so with in moderation. It's also important to make sure you properly identify the plant before you start consuming it, because there are toxic non-native and native species out there. But the common dandelion, you can eat the buds in the spring. You can collect them before the flowers have fully opened and saute them in some butter and salt. They're pretty tasty. You can collect the leaves and eat those. They have a bitter edge to them, but I find them quite tasty and they're very nutritious. Dandelions are great at absorbing all of the nutrients and minerals that are in the soil. They have a really deep taproot, so they can also help kind of break up the soil if it's pretty compacted. And then you can also harvest the flowers themselves. Some people make flower essences out of those flowers. You can make tea with them. And then the root is really medicinal. So the whole root of the dandelion has been used as a diuretic and also detox supplement of sorts. It's really good at cleansing the liver. People use it as a coffee alternative to roasted dandelion root. And you can just collect the whole root, chop it up into small pieces, dehydrate it, roast it a little in a pan, and then steep it like you would coffee or tea. So what I do know about dandelions is that when I was talking about the landscape scale analysis and the cooperative invasive species management area and some of those remote areas, we do have native species of dandelions that grow in the alpine or remote parts of Alaska. And one concern with the common dandelion is that it has been shown to hybridize with native species. And that can create problems because you might create a very aggressive invader that can really outcompete and create monocultures. Also in places like the remote Aleutian Islands, dandelions might have more of a competitive edge to outcompete a meadow and turn into a monoculture. I could also tell you about plantain if you want. Plantain is really interesting because it is one of the most widely distributed plants across the globe. And I looked into this a little bit this morning, and 4,000 years ago during the Stone Age are the earliest records of plantain showing up in Scandinavian countries with like really primitive farming techniques. And then plantago major is the Latin name for it. And planta or planta in Latin means sole of the foot. It basically followed the footprints of Europeans across the globe wherever they went. And so plantain produces a lot of seed, 15,000 to 20,000 seeds per plant that are viable for up to 60 years in the soil. That plant is here to stay with humans. It has been for thousands of years. It is not one that can creep into an intact boreal forest and invade. It's just going to stay in disturbed areas and, you know, areas where there's a lot of light, there's not much canopy, but it can be shaded out. And it is highly medicinal. It's been used in cultures across the world for hundreds of years. It's an anti-inflammatory and an antioxidant. Mostly it's been used for wound healing. So, you know, if in a pinch you get a scratch and you're out and about and you see a plantain leaf that is growing in a place that's relatively clean, you can just pick a leaf, chew it a little bit, put it in the wound. Probably better to make a tincture out of it and have it on hand instead. It's a powerful, powerful plant for sure.
So how about some other weeds that we might encounter that are beneficial?
Pineapple weed is another one, that, or false chamomile. It can be used as a tea. Again, with all of these herbs, it's best to check with your medical provider first before you start introducing it, because I know pineapple weeds sometimes can trigger allergic reactions in people, but it has sedative properties similar to chamomile, so you could pick the flowers and dry them and make tea with them. The leaves, you could also add, they have a bit more of a bitter component, but in general, the pineapple weed has been used for digestion issues. Matricaria discoidea is the Latin name for it. And it does kind of look like a small chamomile flower, too, if you think about it that way.
It has the same, almost the same sort of leaves as chamomile, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yep, yep, it does. It doesn't have any petals. The flower is just a little yellow cone, basically.
Can you think of any others?
You know, chickweed is obviously a common garden weed. A lot of people eat, pretty nutritious. So Stellaria media is the introduced non-native species. And there are several native species of chickweeds. There are also several native species of plantain. I didn't mention that either. But chickweed, while it's really nutritious, you can just eat it fresh, munch on it, put it in your salad. There is some research out there that suggests it has some toxic compounds in it. So again, best to introduce it just in small amounts.
We feed it to our chickens and it makes the yolk really orange.
Oh, cool.
Another weed that we eat pretty regularly is lamb's quarter.
Oh, yeah. That one's really tasty. Yeah, it's got small kind of arrow-shaped leaves up and down the stem. It gets to be 12 to 18 inches tall. kind of fuzzy soft leaves a little bit. Lamb's quarter, again, it's one of those weakly invasive classified plants, so you're going to find it in a lot of disturbed areas where people go. And yeah, you can eat those leaves raw. They're tasty. Add them to salad. But I actually don't know any specific medicinal benefits of lamb's quarter. Ah, consultation with our district manager, Kyra Wagner, says it's said to be more nutritious than spinach.
There might be some other weeds, too, that are actually native that appear in the garden. Can you name any of those?
Sure. Fireweed is often weedy for many gardeners who are trying to grow crops or special vegetables. Fireweed has a persistent root system, but it's also very nutritious. You can eat the shoots in the spring when they're still really tender. You can saute them a little or eat them raw. The flowers are edible, too, so you'll see a lot of the fireweed honeys or jams or jellies.
And then is yarrow?
Oh, yeah. Yarrow is a native plant that's highly medicinal, and it is good for respiratory issues. You can also collect the flowers and the leaves and dehydrate those and put them in tea. You can make a tincture. Also, my partner who does cocktail recipes has designed a yarrow boulevardier. So he distills down the yarrow into a simple syrup and then adds it into the cocktail. Boulevardier, it's a whiskey drink.
That's a new one for me.
Yeah.
There are a couple weeds that when I pull them, I don't know what to do with them. Specifically, hemp nettle and equisetum or horsetail. Do you know of any uses for these?
Yeah, the equisetum or horsetail, I know how the bears use them, which is as a way to scour out their digestive system in the spring. Some hibernating black and brown bears will create an anal plug in the spring or in the fall because they don't eat or drink or poop anything out all winter while they're in that, well, it's false hibernation stage. But anyways, they have a lot to clear out in the spring, and so they'll eat the equisetum to scour out their digestive system.
It's like bear Metamucil.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. And then it's also called scouring rush sometimes. So it's been used to clean out cooking pots, you know, if you don't have a sponge and you're camping or. But yeah, it has a lot of silica in it, which is the same mineral in sand. So it's not an edible one. I will say that equisetum or horsetail does a really good job of sucking up water in the soil and the environment. So on my property where I have a lot of issues with irrigation and too much water flowing across the landscape, I really appreciate when the equisetum is there because it's helping to pull up more of the excess water. The other one you asked about was hemp nettle. Hemp nettle is just kind of a gnarly one. That one is best just to dispose of properly. I will say a lot of these weeds and non-native invasive plants, even if you pluck them when they're in flowering stages, they still have enough energy to convert to seed. And so proper disposal is super important, either bagging them, making sure they fully decompose, or burning them to make sure you aren't spreading them around.
With some of these weeds, can you actually encourage their growth by pulling them?
Yeah, in general, it's best to think about the type of root system the plant has and if you're able to get the whole root system and how does it reproduce. So for a lot of plants, if you prune them or if you clip them or if you pull them and you don't get the entire plant, whatever's left is going to take whatever energy it has and put that energy into vegetative growth. You know, in general, I would say think about the root system, like with the dandelions, right? They have a really deep taproot. And if you don't get the entire taproot, that plant's just going to come up again the next year. And it might decide to shoot out another taproot. But dandelions don't send out rhizomes underground the way reed canary grass does, for instance. You know, burdock is another non-native plant that is considered invasive by some because it is very good at taking over gardens. So if you're planting some of these or leaving some of them, just keep in mind you're going to be actively managing them every year to create balance in your garden. But those plants with deep taproots like dandelions and burdock can break up really compacted soil. So if that's the history of your site, that ground has been heavily compacted, you might want that deep taproot for a little bit. Again, they're prolific seed producers, so you're going to be dealing with that new plants for a long time. And then a lot of those clovers we mentioned earlier, the trifolium species like alcite clover and red clover, those ground covers, those are often used as cover crops at times because they do fix nitrogen and add nitrogen into the soil. If you're trying to convert your property back to a native vegetation ecosystem, you probably do want to get rid of those because they can disturb the natural succession of which plants move in over time. So it's probably best to remove them so that you can get more of the native plants coming in. But in a garden or on a farm, you know, we've already disturbed that landscape. You're actively managing it for something else. Mulch is also a way to minimize the amount of competition that those weeds are creating and help you facilitate growth of the plants you do want.
A lot of people who have livestock will put their animals out to pasture. And when I'm weeding the garden, I usually save the weeds for our goats and our chickens, but I won't give them horsetail because someone told me not to. I'm wondering if this is true or if there's any weeds that should not be given to animals.
Yeah, that's a good question. This is a little outside my area of expertise. I will say with the horsetail or the equisetum, I know that's not great for horses. I don't know about other livestock, but again, because it's mostly silica and there's not a lot of nutritious value in it, I would say that even if it doesn't harm the animal directly, it's probably not great for them to be consuming it or there's no benefit. I have talked to horse owners who, you know, have said there are some issues with alcite clover. There are also some issues with lupin. Lupin is supposed to be toxic to horses. And also, you know, we do have a lot of yellow buttercup species that are in the ranunculus family, which is a very poisonous, toxic family of plants. And so, again, it's important to identify your plants and your weeds that you're pulling from your garden before you decide how to dispose of them or if you're feeding them to animals, because those yellow buttercups are definitely toxic to livestock.
And one weed that you hadn't talked about, or actually it's a native plant, I think, but we won't feed it to our animals, is is it called wild sorrel or Arctic dock, because it's high in oxalic acid.
Yeah. So actually, Arctic dock and the whole sorrel family is a really great one for nibbling on as people, too. It's got a sour, tangy leaf. But yeah, it does have that oxalic acid is what gives it that tangy flavor. And so I'm not sure what sort of impacts that has on livestock. But if you've been advised not to, there's probably a good reason for that. But that's one I add in my salad a little bit here and there, too. Also, it's been an important native food source for a lot of the indigenous cultures in Alaska. Several species in the sorrel family have, you know, cooked down a little bit or mixed in with seal fat in coastal communities. Very nutritious plant.
I think that's all of my questions.
Can I just add a little plug for pushkey or cow parsnip?
Yes.
Cow parsnip or pushkey really does belong here, even though you may not want it in your yard, because it does produce a phytotoxin. It can give you a rash that's sensitive to light. But, you know, it produces a lot of flowers and it feeds a lot of our fly population, and a lot of our flies are eaten by our birds. So I just want to remind folks that all of our native plants are a very important building block to our ecosystem that support insects, birds, small mammals, fish, and our other wildlife. And so the important thing, especially with climatic shifts happening and drought and fire and temperature variances, the more biodiversity of native species that we have in our landscape, the better our chances at having a resilient ecosystem into the future.
Okay, anything else?
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Yeah, it was fun.
And that was Catherine Shakey, the Invasive Species Program Manager at Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, recorded July 2nd, 2021. Coming up next, it's homebrew time. We're going to the brew shop to visit Sean Cullerton and Steve McCaslin to make some dandelion mead.
I'm Sean. I have the brew shop here. 25 years, I guess.
25 years?
I guess I should be proud of that. Proud. That's a long time.
My name is Stephen McCaslin. I'm just a good fan of the brew shop here. And
you're also a brewer yourself.
Oh, brewers are a dime a dozen. No, everybody and their mom is a brewer. Yeah, no, that's So what are you going to make today, Sean?
Oh, well, we're making dandelion wine today.
Dandelion wine?
Dandelion.
Cool.
Mead.
Yes,
okay.
We're using fresh, local honey. and that would be a mead. Des, you got this local honey from out east?
Yeah, it's from my hives. Yeah. So
local honey, this is going to be primo.
If I'm being honest, this is from hives that didn't make it. What? So, you know, cleaning out the hives is not easy or fun after winter when the bees have died inside the hive. There's some mold that'll get on the frames, but I don't feel comfortable eating that honey, but I feel comfortable brewing it because
we're going to heat it up.
Because we're going to heat it up, kind of pasteurize it, I guess.
What about all these dead bees that are in there, Des?
Oh, that's just protein.
So today we're making 5 gallons of mead. We need 1 gallon of honey and 4 gallons of water.
2 gallon bucket of dandelions that we picked this morning.
You got to have a little dandelion picking party, and you pick the heads. That's the easy part. Well, what we've been doing this last little bit of time was separating all the green from the yellow.
Just kind of pinch yellow part out.
So all those heads broke down into about 1 gallon of flower tops.
Yes. I remember one time coming over here and you deep fried some dandelions.
Oh, yeah. They were very good, actually.
Yeah.
We're just going to heat this honey up. And we need to weigh out. 1 gallon.
So, Sean, when I first met you, I think someone introduced me to you as Cheese. Why do people call you Cheese?
Well, when I first got to town, I was working at the little Smoky Bay Co. up there, the natural food store. My job was to, let me phrase this right, cut cheese in small from big, large blocks into smaller blocks. And anyways, I'm working in the deli, and there was 2 Shawns in there. Turns out she was kind of short, and I was kind of tall, and she needed me to grab this pan or that pan from up there. And I'm doing the cheese, and she goes, "You're the big cheese." Everybody laughed, and the name stuck.
But do you sell cheese-making stuff?
I do. I did for a long time, and then I kind of faded out, and I just got back into it. So I got restocked with all the cultures and rennets and molds and waxes and cheesecloth.
Besides cheese-making, this is a place where people would go if they wanted to buy wine supplies or...
Wine supplies, beer. Got the bottles, the fermenters.
Do you soda or kombucha?
Soda and kombucha. Bingo. We are up to 11.5 pounds. One more big scoop. Okay, we got 12 pounds. Now we're going to somehow dissolve all that in the hot water. So here's the hot water already been heating up.
That honey looks so pretty.
It does. It's like, it looks like creamy. This is some awesome looking stuff. Okay, we're going to get all that honey in there and we're going to dissolve it.
Wow, it's so thick.
That is the honey going into the hot water. Some people don't want to boil honey at all. They say it loses the delicate flavors. Kind of like to pasteurize it. Kind of heat it up to about 160, I guess.
I do have some more to pick. Can we throw those in?
You could throw them in later. We could have just made a straight traditional mead, which is just honey, water, and yeast. And then you could flavor it later on down the line if you want. You don't have to. Some meaderies will actually prefer to put it at the end. It's got more flavor.
Do you mean...
After you pitch the yeast, it's bubbling away, and it's, let's just say it's almost done. You can throw some berries in there the last tail end of the fermentation. You get like the bursting raspberry flavor or whatever.
What is actually happening when you make alcohol?
Steve,
do you know what's actually happening?
The yeast.
You know, the yeast, she eats sugar. And she makes 2 byproducts from eating that sugar. And one of them is carbon dioxide and the other one is alcohol. It's just the exhaust of her eating that sugar. She's who's doing it. The yeast is the queen. The yeast is the mysterious mother that makes all this happen. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, you know, it was just a heavenly thing that they couldn't explain, but they knew that if they did this and this, and they were just repetitious in their actions, that this is what would happen.
We're going to take the temp. We got a thermometer. And back to that, some people just barely heat it up. We're up to 140.
Let's get a little hotter, and then we'll turn the heat off and let it steep.
Okay.
And we're going to add a lemon, a little slice of lemon.
What does the lemon do?
I think it's good. It helps the acidity, and it helps for ferment. They got these things called acid blend. In the wine world, I think it likes to be a little acidic. Is it? Certain yeasts ferment better.
It seems like dandelion wine is, it's a simple wine.
We're going to try to keep it simple. I mean, you start messing with it too much, and some flavors get in the way of the flavors that you really want to come through. Simple is very good. That's a good thing.
Is that how you approach brewing at the brewery?
Yeah, well, I mean, we make traditional country ales. We haven't really kept up with the 21st century as far as what a lot of other breweries are doing. We make standard ales. We're not putting plum, granite, coconut, anything in the beer. It's malt, it's hops, it's yeast. Now, if we add any kind of adjunct to our beer, it needs to be local.
Those are the beers of the brewery that I enjoy the most. Yesterday I went to the brewery and I had a raspberry porter.
Yeah, a raspberry porter, yeah.
That was very good. Yeah. Before I have had spruce tip.
The spruce tip, another good example, you bet.
For me, because I'm a brewer, it's nice to see the local combinations and what people are doing and how they're incorporating the local plants into their brews.
That's what you, exactly. It needs to be grown locally. You don't want it to slap you around. You want to taste it. Because sometimes you can overwhelm a beer with adding too much, and then it kind of takes away then from the beer angle of vision too, because it's just too fruity. But there's so many ways, so many different ways to skin a cat that you just gotta skin yours the way you want to skin it, and whatever fits your personality and your customers and all that.
Okay, so this is heating up. That's the sound of the honey and water together. Oh, there is a bee in there. Oh, my God. We'll just spoon him out of there. There's a couple bee parts, bee wings and stuff. That makes the best mead, honestly. No, I'm serious.
It's true.
That means it's like the real deal. Okay, we're up to 160. We're going to call that good. So, we'll drop a couple lemon wedges in there. And, Des, you want to do the dandelion honors since you did most of the picking? So, these are going to go in.
So, in the meantime, do we have our equipment cleaned?
Good question. I have this 5-gallon fermenter bucket here, and I got some sterilizer. It's sitting in there, and it's ready to go. Just got to rinse it out with some fresh water, and we're going to pour all this hot mixture in there.
What kind of yeast do you think that we should use?
I've had excellent luck with the champagne yeast, so why mess with a good thing? And the packet's yellow, so that's also why I like it for dandelions.
For dandelions.
Yeah.
Does the champagne yeast make the wine?
It's actually from the Champagne region. It doesn't guarantee it's going to be sparkly. It can handle a high alcohol content. This can go up to like 18% alcohol. We don't know how strong this is quite yet, but we'll take the gravity reading right before we put the yeast in so we know. So my guess is it's going to be around 10%. This is a wine that gets better with age. I had some dandelion wine once, and it wasn't my favorite, I'll be honest. It was rocket fuel-ish. Well, I put it away for a year or two or three even. I forgot about it in the closet. And years later, it was awesome. That's the one that won the homebrew contest. I was just like, I don't know, I'll enter it. It turned out excellent.
I'm trying to find the two-headed dandelion. I picked one this morning that had two heads.
Ah, two heads. Wow. Never seen that. I would also say, when you pick these guys, make it that day. Just go ahead and make it.
Dandelions are a huge food source for bees.
Yeah, the earliest. Yeah, these come out. It's supposedly it's very important for the pollinators.
So then once we throw this batch of dandelions in, then...
We'll cool it down.
Cool it down.
And then we're going to get it to about 80 degrees, or maybe a little less than 80. That's kind of important. You don't want it to be too hot, otherwise it'll kill the yeast when we sprinkle that in there.
Do you want to get the temperature down fast, or does it matter?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In general, definitely in the beer world, you want to chill it down quick and get that yeast working before anything else has a chance to, you know, maybe get at it. Wild yeast. We're going to have an airlock on there, and we're going to watch it bubble. And it should bubble for about at least a couple few weeks. About a month.
So once once that month is over, are we going to rack it?
We're going to rack it, and then we're going to get rid of all these dandelions that are going to be floating around in there. Clean it up.
So racking is just when you...
Racking's a term for, what is that now? Take it from one container to the next and let it settle and then bottle it. So you get a lot cleaner product in your bottle. You don't want a bunch of floaty stuff in there, or yeast in there, or whatever. So some people will rack it once a month as a general rule until it's clear. Every batch is a little different. Before we put the yeast in there, we're going to take a hydrometer reading and see how strong it is. And I can sneak a sample right now.
The hydrometer, that measures potential sugar?
Yeah. Hydrometer reads true when it's 60 degrees. So if it's hotter than that, I'm sure you've got a little...
There's a chart you got to adjust.
A chart, and you have to add or subtract.
So if it's warmer, which it usually is, it's usually 70 or 80 when you're reading it. If it says 10%, you can almost add.
Yeah.
It's going to be 12.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's the good news.
After we've gotten our mead is made, we're going to put it into our clean fermenter.
Yep.
We're going to top it off to 5 gallons. Then we're going to wait till it cools down to pitch the yeast.
Yep.
When it's being stored and while it's fermenting, does it have to be a certain temperature?
Yeah, that's huge. If it's too hot, I mean, sometimes it gets really hot and you might get a headache or something if it's fermenting really high temperatures.
It creates what they call fusel alcohol.
Yeah, you want a nice, smooth, mellow.
And fusel alcohols, I mean, there's like 9 different types of alcohol. And fusel is one, like in my beer world, if the fermentation temperature gets too hot, fusel alcohols have a reputation of, you know, you consume them and then the next day you might have kind of a heavy head. It might be kind of achy. So temperature during fermentation is very, very important.
We got a temperature strip on this guy. So that'll tell us. See the strip here it is? And so it says if it's 62, 72. 80. So we know. Otherwise, a lot of times you're just kind of guessing.
And you also kind of want it to be a stabilized temperature, right?
Pretty much. But people brew in cabins and stuff. It fluctuates temperature. Don't let that stop you. Once it starts bubbling, it'll keep going. Even if it's a little on the chilly side, it'll just go a little slower. But yeah. And honey's a slow fermenter in general.
That just because of the sugar?
I guess it's just harder for the yeast to break down that sugar, yeah.
So you're saying everybody has different ways of making it. What are some
of the some people
ways?
Put raisins in there and brown sugar, I've heard. Regular white sugar, I'm sure that would work fine too. For orange peel, maybe a cinnamon stick. Ginger, whatever you want to throw in there. This is the time, like it's steeping, you're kind of making tea. So we are gonna rinse that sanitizer out of the sterilizer bucket. Give it a dump that and we're gonna rinse it.
Why do you need an airlock?
Okay, so like we were saying, when the yeast goes in there, it's gonna kick off CO2. And you need to let that escape. In the old days, they'd put a balloon on there or whatever. And so, but this is an airlock, and you put a little water in there, and it's going to let the air get out through the water, but it's not going to let the outside air get back in. So it's like a one-way valve. It's insurance policy, so the fermenter will be clean and not contaminated. I like to seal it, and then you can watch it bubble, and go bloop, bloop, bloop.
Once it stops bubbling, does that mean it's close to done?
That's your big clue that it's done, yeah. It'll bubble fast in the beginning, just kind of slow down, and then it'll really slow down. And then you're getting close. Some people bottle it a little too soon. And, you know, if it's still perking away in the fermenter and you bottle it too soon, you might hear of, exploding bottles or what. You might have heard of stories like that.
Oh, I've experienced them personally.
Yeah. So if one bottle of the batch starts to go, you better start, put them in a cold spot or just drink them fast, I guess. Moving right along. Okay, here comes the hot stuff. Into the bucket. Tons of dandelions. Oh, a couple lemons. Oh, more dandelions.
And so now can we add the cold water?
We're going to add a little bit of cold sterile water, and that's going to help chill it down really good. And then we're going to put the yeast in there. And then in about a month, we'll rack it. I know how much that is. Oh, it doesn't matter because there's gallon lines on there.
Mm-hmm.
We marked the bucket with gallon lines on the outside, so we know. A little marker. So now's when we should take the reed hydrometer reading to see how strong it is.
Okay. Get in there. Go, 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 go.
1080, so that would be translation, potentially 11% alcohol. That's pretty good. If you want it stronger, we could add more honey at this point. If you'd want it less, you would add a little water. We're going to keep it the way it is. So that's a pretty good, that's about the strength of a bottle of wine you get in a store. Very drinkable. Okay, and so maybe just wait a little bit till it cools down a little more, and then we can add the yeast.
All right.
And then it'll be bubbling. Oh, we're sprinkling yeast down there.
You just add it straight to it. You don't...
Some people hydrate it and stuff. I got two packs. So I'm going to put one in and stir it. And the second pack's going to go sprinkling right on the top.
Wow. We did good, Diz. I can't believe it.
I can.
Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of news and tidbits on local agriculture and wild habitat too. It's that time of year to begin thinking about preserving the summer bounty, which means it's time to get your pressure canner gauge tested. The UAF Cooperative Extension will be offering their annual free testing of pressure canner dial gauges at the Homer Farmers Market July 17th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Bring the gauge or the gauge attached to the lid to the market and it will take just a few minutes. It is important to have gauges tested annually to assure home canned food is safely processed. For more information, contact Linda Tannehill from the Cooperative Extension at 907-262-3440 or by email at lktannehill@alaska.edu. That's lktannehill@alaska.edu. And right now, Homer is celebrating the second annual Peony Celebration, which began earlier this month and runs through July 24th. Homer is proud to have 25 peony farms, and both visitors and locals are invited to join in the events celebrating the beautiful, fragrant blooms. There are many opportunities lined up this year to just soak in the peonies, and include tours of peony farms, including Scenic Place Peonies, Alaska Perfect Peony, Anchor Point Greenhouse, Joslyn Peony Farm, and the Alaska Beauty Peony Co-op's Blooms and Brews Tour, and bouquet design workshops at several of the farms. There are also kids' events, plein air painting and other peony-themed art workshops at Homer Council on the Arts, gallery shows, garden parties and other events at the Pratt Museum, the Bunnell Arts Peonies and Pizza Concert, and wine tastings at Bear Creek Winery with self-guided tours of their peony gardens. All the details and the calendar of events can be found on the Homer Chamber of Commerce's website. And lastly, save the date. Coming up August 6th, 7th, and 8th, the Kenai Peninsula 4-H is hosting their Agriculture Expo at the Soldotna Sports Center. In addition to the livestock shows, livestock auctions, and the petting zoo, there is also a slate of learning sessions for adults being offered by people with expertise in Alaskan agriculture. Topics include biosecurity on your backyard farm, steps to reduce risk of infectious disease, hydroponic vegetable production, keeping your trees healthy, soil health, what lies beneath, hay production, backyard poultry, raising sheep and market lambs, raising honeybees, and raising and processing your homegrown hogs. Find the schedule and the details on the Kenai Peninsula 4-H website.
And that's the show. Running short on time, so I just want to let you know that you can email your questions, comments, or corrections to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer.
Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In Homer at 3939 Lake Street and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Additional support for Homer Grown comes from Wagon Wheel Garden and Pet, providing plants and garden supplies for South Peninsula's gardeners.
Open year round Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 5. Learn more at akwagonwheel.com and at 907-235-8777.